Okay, so what I'd like to do now is we've gone gradually, bit by bit, through the different things sort of before the Buddha, sort of looking at the context for what the Buddha was in, and just having a bit of a survey on the background. So what I'd like to do for the remainder of these history classes is then sort of bring the timeline forward and look at what happened after the time of the Buddha. We're sort of leaping over the Buddha himself, of course, which is what we're studying in the Sutta and Vinaya classes. And I'd like to look at the period, what happened after the Buddha passed away. And that, of course, takes us into the period of the councils, King Ashoka, the schisms, and so on. And so we'd like to have a bit of a look at what is the context that Buddhism grew up in India. All right. So, just to give a bit of an overview before we start. So here's a bit of an overview. It's a timeline of Buddhist history. And more recent research tends to put the dates of the Buddha around 490 to 410 BCE. Okay, passing away, so born around 500 BCE, passing away around 420, maybe 400 BCE, something like that. Because we don't really know what the Buddha's dates were, we just make it up and pretend that we do. Often you'll see the date of his passing away at 483 BC, and that's based on a revised version of the Sinhala dating, and that was sort of current in Buddhist studies for about 100 years, but then it was sort of went out of fashion, and then this date went out of fashion, and then for a while a new fashion came in of putting it much later, of putting 350 BCE. So that's quite a big difference, based on the northern sources, and then in the last 10 years or so, that date's gone out of fashion, and the new fad is about 410 or so BCE, and that generally seems to be supported by most of the English scholars, Norman and Cousins and Gombrich and so on. That's a date that I follow in my research. And just note a few things happening around the time. Persian Empire, Cyrus the Great, around the same time. A little bit earlier. Confucius, a little bit earlier. Zarathustra, I don't know whether Zarathustra's got historical dates or not, but anyway.
Zoroastrian, I think.
Yeah.
Mazda.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Zuzu.
And birth of Mahavira, the founder of Jainism. 550. First Buddhist council at Rajagaha, so that should be all of these dates should then be adopted. They're still maintained for the thinking the Buddha died at 486, but these dates are based on the Buddha's Parinibbana. So it's 100 years after he passed away. Oh, sorry, just after he passed away is the first council. So we would say 410, 420. And similar dates to Socrates, Plato. Battle of Marathon, Greek-Persian Wars. So this is very much in the great period of this is what they call the Axial Age, and sort of the great Greek philosophers, Confucius and Lao Tzu in China. Also the Empire of Cyrus the Great and the redaction of the Old Testament happened around this time as well. Second Buddhist Council, so that's 100 years after the Parinibbana, so we're talking maybe 310 if we adapt the dates. First schism didn't occur then, according to Sujato, the authority on the matter. Anyway, read my article on that. Around the time of Aristotle and Alexander the Great. So interestingly enough, if we correct these dates to around 310 or 320 for the Second Council, then it comes almost exactly the same time that Alexander the Great was invading. And it's, you know, one of these curious little quirks of Indian history that we have this story about how the monks were debating about whether you could take people's offering of a coin when you're walking for alms in the streets, and no one bothers to write anything about Alexander the Great invading. It's completely unmentioned in the Indian histories.
Is that fine at all?
Sorry?
Maybe it was a metaphor for.
Does that tie in at all with that Greek monk?
Yonika Dhammarakita.
Yeah.
No, he was in Ashoka's time.
Oh, a lot later.
About 50 years later, yeah.
Which would make sense if the Greeks were coming over with Alexander.
That's right,
getting
yeah.
Getting into Buddhism, go back home to tell people about it, and they get curious, go back.
Yeah, it didn't quite happen like that. Yeah,
no?
Actually, no.
Oh. Just a theory.
They actually came over and like killed people and stuff. Yeah.
They weren't, actually, yeah, they weren't
coming on meditation retreats. But anyway, let's continue. Reign of King Ashoka, 272 to 231, and those dates are fairly firm. So that's just about the first firm dates we've got. We've got no Alexander from the Greek sources, but first firm internal dates. King Ashoka, around the time of the Great Wall of China built. Hadrian's Wall, Hannibal, not Hannibal Lecter, who converts and establishes the Buddhist Dhamma on a national level for the first time. Okay, the third Buddhist council at Pataliputta under the patronage of Ashoka, about 200 years. Now again, if we've adopted our dates, then we're now talking about 150 years. So King Ashoka is about 150 years if we've taken the more modern dating system, 420, say 410, 420 BCE, so King Ashoka then would have come to power about 150 years after the Parinirvana. Modern Pali Tripitaka was not essentially complete and had many things added to it after the time of Ashoka. Ashoka's son and missionary Mahinda established Buddhism in Sri Lanka. Okay, 2nd century BCE, beginnings of Mahayana Buddhism. That's got no basis in actual fact, unfortunately. A composition of Prajnaparamita literature. Let's take that another 2 centuries down this way. Okay. Oh, that's the perfection of wisdom. It's a large class of Mahayana sutras. Yeah. The Heart Sutra is usually regarded as a summary of the Prajnaparamita. Yeah. So two Buddhist missionaries, historical record, arrived in China in 68 AD, according to the Chinese records. Is that right? I'm not sure about these dates. These are the dates on the left and the right don't agree with each other. We've got 2nd century, and here we've got, this agrees with the 2nd century, but this is the 68 AD. Certainly it was around 68 AD that the first Chinese, it wasn't the 2nd century that the Chinese arrived in India, the Indians arrived in Chinese, Buddhism arrived there. It was around the turn of the Common Era. Okay. 1st century, writing down of the Pali Canon in the Aloka cave, the Alavihara. It's recorded in the Mahavamsa, so it's the first record of the writing down of the scriptures. King Kanishka, again, they're approximate dates. Around 100 CE, convened what's called the Fourth Council, which essentially the purpose of that was to redact the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma. Okay, so then we're going on to some kind of later.
So the Sarvastivadin's version of the Abhidharma?
Yeah.
Okay, so which is why it's not recognised by Theravada.
That's right.
Do you know what the controversial point is that they tried to introduce, or were there many?
Oh, it's a completely different system.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Okay, composition of Lotus Sutra and other Mahayana Buddhist texts, starting around this time. Buddha first represented Nata in human form, 1st century CE. 2nd century, age of Buddhist philosophers, Nagarjuna, again, bit of a guess, nobody really knows what Nagarjuna's dates were. 2nd century is pretty much an average. Shunga dynasty in India. Expansion of Buddhism to Burma, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and Indonesia. Yogacara school founded by Maitreya Nata. This is one of the schools, philosophical schools of Mahayana called the Yogacara. So the two great, Mahayana has two great philosophical schools. One's called Madhyamaka, one's called Yogacara. And these are some more or less the traditional dates of the founding of those. It's not at all clear whether this is actual person or not. It means Lord Maitreya. So it may well be that a lot of the Mahayana writers claim that they were inspired by various figures, including quite often Maitreya. So it may well have been that it's a legendary inscription to a sort of a text that was inspired by a meditation vision of Maitreya rather than being literally written by a person called Maitreya. Okay. Emperor Constantine converts to Christianity, 312. And then around 310 to 390, and curiously enough, Asanga lived from 310 to 390, and his brother, Vasubandhu, lived from 420 to 500. giving you an idea of the vagueness of the dating systems that were working here. And they both ended up being...
interesting genetics.
The cosmopolitan
factor. No, they were brothers. They're full brothers, but it's just the dates. So.
Really, yeah. Separated like 80 or 90 odd years.
Oh, 100
years. Getting on a bit.
They did Ayurvedic medicine and stuff. Yeah. So, they were actually both brothers and also contemporaries. But they were the great philosophers of the Yogacara school. And so when we talk about the Madhyamaka school, really the great one we're talking about is Nagarjuna. And the Yogacara, the great ones are Asanga and Vasubandhu. Asanga being more of a systematic philosopher who sort of went methodically, he was the great commentator, went methodically through the scriptures and compiled very systematic commentaries, whereas Vasubandhu was... the description of the difference was that when they were being taught, that Vasubandhu would understand everything the first time, and Asanga would understand it after being explained two or three times. So even though Asanga was the elder brother, Vasubandhu is regarded as being more brilliant, more brilliant intellect, and his treatises tend to be. Vasubandhu had an interesting history. He started out as a Sarvastivada, then converted to the Sautrantika. And then from Sautrantika converted to Yogacara. So there's a lot of controversy in modern Buddhist studies about whether there was only one Vasubandhu or whether there were several of them, because they have such different opinions in the different texts described to him. Okay, development of Vajrayana Buddhism in India? Perhaps. I'm not sure what evidence they've got to say Vajrayana was being developed at such an early date, but in any case. So Kumarajiva, he's one of the great Chinese translators working around this time, and this is the time that we've seen is the time of the translation of most of the Agama and Vinaya texts into Chinese, and 400 or so.
So it's quite late before they start to make their way to China in terms of text.
Yeah, there's text trickling in from the first century
right.
into China, and so we have some dates of things from there, but nothing methodical. The actual first complete Agamas and Vinayas were around this time.
So we're talking at least two or three hundred years after the Buddha's death before anything makes its way north to China.
Oh no, more than that, about 500 years.
500 years.
Yeah, 500 years. Yeah.
Jeez.
400 or 500 years, and they're the first dated things. So the Chinese were very much more concerned with dating things. So we've got a lot of accurate translation dates in China.
So you can rely more upon that to be.
Yeah, that was it. So we know the date when they arrived in China, but we don't know the date when the texts were actually composed in India. Yeah. Okay, blah blah blah. Fa Xiang visits India, 6th-5th century, Buddha Gosa, founding of Nalanda, Buddhism in Burma and Korea. Fa Xiang visits India, Amitabha sect emerges in China, 5th century, Sri Lankan Theravada nuns introduced formation into China, 433. Mahayana Buddhism introduced into Java, Sumatra and Borneo, mainly by Indian immigrants. Anglo-Saxon invasion of England. I wonder what England was like in those days. Okay, earliest hospital in Sri Lanka, 437. Okay, Bodhidharma arrives in China from India. So this is going more into the development of Chinese and Japanese Buddhism, so around 6th century. Muhammad's appearing in the West, Buddhism flourishing in China and Indonesia. 7th century, it starts to go to Tibet. Okay, so Buddhism was in China for a full 500 years, more over 500 years before it arrived in Tibet. Okay,
and they're part of China.
Yeah.
It's a strange place.
So around this time, interesting, like if you had the pilgrim Xuanzang, and interestingly, if you compare the account of Fa Xian, who is around here, with Xuanzang writing a couple of hundred years later, Xuanzang talks a lot more about the decline of Buddhism, like finding empty monasteries in different places, and he'll quite often say he arrived in a certain town and there were three monasteries and two of them were empty or something like that. So it seems that already by this time there's a sort of a decline in Buddhism.
In China?
No, in India.
In India,
yeah. And we only know really about what was happening, you know, our two sources of information really are the accounts of the Chinese pilgrims and the archaeological evidence. The Indians themselves didn't leave any historical records or any serious ones. So 8th century, academic schools proliferate in Japan in the Nara period. It's kind of a university, big Buddhist university in Japan. Samye Monastery in Tibet, debate between Tibetan and Chinese Buddhist schools. So this is where the king of Tibet had to decide whether to accept Buddhism from India or from China. And the Chinese lost that debate, even according to their own records. Interestingly, the actual debate was about whether about the way you could get the way to enlightenment. So the Indian scholar was arguing that the Buddha was like the spiritual practice is an illness or a disease, and like a doctor will prescribe many different medicines and treatments for different diseases. And so the Buddha prescribed different practices to address different afflictions. Whereas the Chinese Chan philosopher declared that mind was the essence of everything, and so that the practice of awareness itself was enough to solve all problems. Yeah? And then he gave an example, a medical example, just like such and such, and he named some kind of medicine they used to use, I think it might have been ginger even, was useful for treating all diseases. So too the practice of mindful awareness is useful for treating all spiritual problems. So this was the basic dispute between the two schools. And the Chinese one lost, had to be chased out of the country, otherwise the king would have killed him.
So he was using the Indian philosophy or technique to try and explain the basis for the Zen approach.
Yeah, of course.
Which is why he failed, because the other one was proposing this.
It wasn't because it was Indian or not, but it was just whether they agreed and wasn't convinced by his philosophy or something. So that's why Tibet then took its Buddhism from India. Nyingma civil established, Borobudur complex built in Java. Muslims invading from Central Asia. Jataka tales translated into Syrian and Arabic. Okay, 9th century Khmer kings build Angkor Wat, the world's largest religious monument. And until recent times, Angkor Wat, they've recently found out, was the biggest human settlement anywhere in the world until the modern period. Tendai School in Japan. First printed book is the Diamond Sutra in China, 1868. biography of the Buddha, translated into Greek by St. John of Damascus and distributed in Christianity as Balaam and Yosafat. Yosafat being a corruption of Bodhisat. So, Great Buddha's persecution in China, 845, and there was a very short but very intense period of suppression of Buddhism in China. It only lasted for 2 or 3 years, but during that period, a lot of the diversity of Chinese schools, like we've seen up above here, many different schools appearing in China, and a lot of that diversity was wiped out after that period. And then after that, you had the kind of the appearance of the two great Chinese schools, the Pure Land and the Chan, became dominant after that period.
It seems to have a bit of a time with the Muslim invasion in India. Would that be following on from that?
Hard to say. Yeah, hard to say. It could do. I mean, you certainly had a tendency to consolidate, certainly in South Asia. Because they would have been well aware of the Muslim invasions. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And so that's when you had the sort of consolidation of the disparate forms of Buddhism in South and Southeast Asia under Theravada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And so, you know, you can see that would, you know, you've lost your heartland. And so the border regions would be starting to think, oh, getting a bit nervous.
Yeah.
So whether that influence was felt indirectly in China, I mean, they were never threatened so directly, but I couldn't say, yeah.
Because you've got the Angkor Wat thing happening here, and other temples being established in Indonesia and stuff like that, and then you've got this purging happening.
But that purge was by Confucianists,
right.
Not by Muslims.
The Khmer kings were also
That's right, yeah. Angkor Wat is kind of a syncretic, it's more of a tantric culture than anything else. So kind of by that time, Buddhism and Hinduism become so blended that, it wasn't easy to tell the difference. Yeah. First complete printing of Chinese canon, Sichuan edition, 900. Buddhism in Thailand, 900 to 1,000. It's a bit controversial. I think Buddhism was in Thailand a lot earlier than that, but probably certainly in southern Thailand and the areas nearby. But there's a lot which is unknown. I mean, even when I was in Thailand, at our local local forest monastery, they had the typical way that how it ties to archaeology. The local Lumpur goes and sits in Samadhi, and comes out of Samadhi and then tells the lay people, they just got this new monastery, right? They haven't been a monastery before, they just got a piece of land and offered it to build a monastery. And Longpaw goes and sits there and then tells the lay people, dig over there. And they said, what are we digging for? He said, just dig over there. He said, what are we doing, Longpaw? He said, just dig over there. So they dig and there's an ancient stupa under the ground that you couldn't see at all. And they dug this thing up and then they took a brick from it and sent it down to Bangkok to the university archaeology department, and they said that, you know, it's very, very old and that they had no historical records of any settlement in the area at that time. So.
Just luck.
So, there's various things like that. Another story I heard of somebody, some monk, saying that they'd had an imiter of a very ancient Buddha image in the Mekong River. Somebody somehow got dumped in the Mekong, a very, very ancient one, and they were going to arrange a party to go and find it and dig it up. And then one of the other monks, because, you know, it was just near his monastery, and then one of the other monks said, "Ah, don't, Longpo, I'll just leave it." You know, he said, "You know, as soon as they dig that up, all the tourists will be coming to your monastery, and never get any peace." He said, "Yeah, you're probably right. We'll just leave it." So there's very incomplete records. So okay, 1000 CE, 200 million people in the world. Islam replaces Buddhism in Central Asia. 1000 conversion of Pagan. Around this time, they had some pretty terrible slaughters and fights in Burma over Buddhism or involving Buddhism. Ended up, of course, establishing the Theravada. Confucian revival. So these are some of the great Tibetan sages, Atisha, Marpa, and Milarepa. The dying out of Buddhism in Sri Lanka around 11th century. Okay, the great schism in Christianity between the Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches. Crusades. So it was around this period that Theravada was reunited and re-established. The three schools in Sri Lanka were united into one, and they also sort of joined forces with the Buddhists in Thailand and Burma. Okay, founding of Pure Land and Rinzai Zen School in Japanese Buddhism. Muslims attacked and destroyed Buddhism in Magadha, Wallabi and Nalanda, and wiped out Buddhism forever. In India, for hundreds of years anyway. 13th century, Pure Land, Dogen found it arriving. Some Buddhist texts still being translated into Arabic and Persian. Bustam collects and edits the Tibetan Buddhist canon. Buddhism becomes state religion of China, of Thailand in 1360. Theravada Buddhism. Okay, so we won't go into the rest of the history, but that's just a general overview. So, in Indian Buddhism, it's convenient to think of Indian Buddhism in terms of three major periods. First period being we call the early period, it's the first 500 years. The middle period is the second 500 years. Late period is the third 500 years. And in the first 500 years, it's basically characterized by the emergence of we call it early, the early Buddhist period, the emergence of the Buddhist schools and the redactions of the old canons, the Agamas and Vinaya literature, the development of the Abhidhamma, and the time of King Ashoka, popularization of Buddhism under King Ashoka. So these are some of the main events in the first 500 years. So I'll just briefly, I don't want to go into too much detail in these, but just briefly review some of the main events of this first period, okay? So the early period, the first 500 years. So the first event we have is the first council. And after the Buddha passed away, and tells his, and we have this story immediately after the Parinibbana Sutta. This is Mahakasapa. This is in the Pali Vinaya. I'm going to read in the Pali one. I'm going to read something more interesting. Pali one's boring. You can find it anywhere. The Hishastika one you can only find from Satipata. Okay. So this is...
is this the more racy version?
Ah, I don't know about racy, but it's on our website, so... it's got to be good. Okay, the Buddha had not long ended Parinibbana. Kassapa was staying in Vesali at the monkey pond in the hall with a pointed roof. The great sangha of 500 bhikkhus and all the arahants except Ananda. And Kassapa said to the bhikkhus...
Is that incorrect, Hunter?
What?
Wasn't Ananda supposed to be the 500th arahant?
Yeah. Haven't reached that bit yet.
There are some bhikkhus.
Said, Mahakasapa said to the bhikkhus, okay, when I was going from Pava towards Kusinara, and between the two countries I heard the Buddha passed away, at that time I was confused and lost in my heart, not able to contain myself. It's an interesting description of Kasapa. The idea of arahant in some of the other Buddhist schools is not quite the same as we're used to in Theravada. All the village bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen cried, fell down and rolled on the ground. There was not one who was not crying, wailing and sighing. Too soon the world is afflicted, empty. The world's eye is gone. At that time, Upananda had already arrived there. So Upananda is a bad Sakyan. Often the Pali version has Subhadda. Stop everyone, he says. That elder, that means the Buddha, was always saying, you should do this, you should not do that, you should train like this, you should not train like that. Now we're free from this suffering. We can do what we want with no opposition. Why are you all crying? So, I heard what he said and was seriously worried. Even though the Buddha's entered Parinibbana, the Vinaya still remains. We should gather in unity for a council. Don't let Upananda establish a separate following and ruin the true Dhamma. All the bhikkhus completely agreed and said to Kassapa, Ananda always waited on the Buddha. He's intelligent. He's learned much and remembers the Dhammapitaka. Now he should be allowed to be numbered among the bhikkhus. Kassapa said, Ananda is still a trainee. Because he has greed, hatred, delusion and fear, we should not include him. At that time, Ananda was saying vesely, day and night, teaching the Dhamma to the fourfold assembly. People were coming and going, almost like when the Buddha was alive. There was a Vajiputtika bhikkhu sitting meditation upstairs in that building. Because of the noise and confusion, he could not get the liberation of samadhi. He thought, now Ananda is a trainee. He's not yet finished what he has to do, and is always among the bustle of teaching. He entered samadhi and observed that Ananda could achieve the task, and he thought, now I should speak to shake him up and be a cause for awakening. So he went to Ananda and spoke the following verse.
Before you go, Ananda, you're not talking about Mahakasapa here as the Vajiputtika.
No.
So this is just some other random bhikkhu.
It's some other random bhikkhu.
Right, he's going to give it to Ananda.
Clarify that. In a secluded place, sitting under the tree, the mind goes to Nibbana. If you meditate, not heedless, why is there much talking? And the bhikkhu has also said to another, you should quickly do what's to be done. Kassapa now wishes to collect the Vinaya Dhamma and won't allow you to be in the gathering. Interesting how completely unprecedented this whole procedure is, okay? Mm-hmm. There's no procedure whatsoever that under Vinaya that allows that only arahants should do something that someone who's not an arahant shouldn't, or that says that one monk has the right to include or exclude anyone from the community. Yeah, he's just completely against Vinaya. Anyway.
This is in line with the whole Bodhisattva teachings that we find in Mahayana, in terms of the Buddha's there, the Bodhisattva's there, and then there's a trainee, and the Bodhisattva sees it fit to talk instead of the Buddha, because obviously he's got no idea, and tells the monk how he should be practicing, especially if it's Sariputta or one of these other characters who we have got no idea. But that's the same model. I just see the same process being used.
Maybe.
This is something I found quite interesting. If you read some of the Mahayana sutras, the Bodhisattva's there and they'll teach in front of the Buddha instead of the Buddha teaching.
Okay. Anyway, right. What is true, actually, is that this idea you find in Mahayana sutras where the arahants get criticized all the time, that certainly comes from, it's inspired by these kinds of passages. Okay, having heard that verse from the Vajiputtika bhikkhu, Ananda further heard that Kassapa would not let him into the Vinaya gathering. Throughout the night, he practiced walking meditation, reflecting on gaining liberation, but he was not able to get it. As night was ending, his body was so tired, he wished to have a little lie down. While his head had not yet reached the pillow, suddenly his mind was freed from the defilements. And again, interesting to notice, why is this a Vinaya gathering, a recitation of the Vinaya? Notice the reason for it is because of Vinaya, that Upananda says, now we can do whatever we want. And so Kassapa sort of takes that and is now going to have a recitation of the Vinaya. It's kind of curious, isn't it? Why the recitation of the Vinaya or has to do with the recitation of the Dhamma, or just this shift in how it's being conceived. Okay. And the bhikkhus now said to Kassapa, last night Ananda found liberation. Now he should be included in the Vinaya gathering. Kassapa approved and then had the thought, where can we find sufficient food and drinks and lodgings? Where can we get sufficient support to hold a Vinaya gathering? Only in Rajagaha is there sufficient wealth to support such a gathering. Thereupon he announced to the Sangha, these 500 arahants should stay in Rajagaha for the Vasa. Not even one other person should go there. I've made that rule already. The 500 arahants went to Rajagaha. In the first month of the Vasa, they repaired the dwellings. I'll just repeat that. In the first month of the Vasa, the 500 arahants repaired the dwellings. Is anyone unclear about that? Would you like an explanation?
Yeah,
I have a question.
Giving great examples of how to behave properly.
I know, I agree, but it's very good because it highlights that outside of that period, the rest of the year, they weren't. I'd like that, that's great.
They were wandering around, staying in the forest, meditating.
So most of the year, they're not building or repairing.
All right?
Right, got it.
So, in the first month of the Vasa, they repaired the dwellings. In the second month, they all freely enjoyed the various jhanas and liberations. In the third month, they gathered in one place. So they, according to this version, they did the recitation in the third month. Right? Not all that long. Kāśyapa said to the Sangha, "May the period of time gets longer and longer as time goes on, according to late commentarial versions, it was like 7 months, because that's how long it would take to recite everything these days, but obviously the canon was probably a lot shorter. Kāśyapa said to the Sangha, "May the Venerable Sangha hear me. Now I will question Venerable Upali in the Sangha regarding the Vinaya. If the Sangha is ready, may it consent to listen." They said, "So be it." So of course this is classic formula for Sangha Kama, which is like a Vinaya act. Okay, so he's presenting everything as if it's an act of Vinaya. It's a very curious way of doing it. Like you find all through the suttas that you never find any precedent for this. And you know, there's several places where councils are taught about, where the Buddha says you should get together and all recite together and all of these kinds of things. And he says, here's what you should recite, and gives a list of teachings. So it's mentioned quite a few times, and there's never any hint that it's got to do with this kind of formal Vinaya procedure. So this is the way that because it's made into a Vinaya procedure, of course, this is also the reason why everybody else is excluded. That's why there's no bhikkhunis present, because it's a Vinaya procedure done by the bhikkhus. It's why there's no lay people present. Okay, and it's also why they excluded all the other monks from the area. Like Rajagaha was one big sima. So if you know the geography of Rajagaha, it's actually a ring of hills around the central valley. And actually that whole region had been made into one sima. So that if they were performing a Sangha Kama within that, all of the monks within that sima had to be present. And that's why they had to exclude the other Sangha.
It's also interesting, just previous to this Panta, where it says about the arahants gathering, enjoying the various jhanas and liberations in the second month. Because obviously, you know, arahants would find it hard to get into a jhana because all the defilements are there, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be written by somebody who doesn't really understand much about practice.
I don't know. What's the problem?
Well, why would arahants not be able to attain jhana, for example, or liberations? What liberations would they have to attain?
That's what it's saying that they just...
Whilst they're building, it's like implying whilst they're building.
No, the first month they repaired the buildings. Second month they did their meditation, and third month they did recitation.
But it just feels to me that the way that's written, it's implying that the first month they can't do jhanas or liberations or anything like that, because they're too busy building.
I think you're over-interpreting the text.
Really? It's just a feeling like it.
Okay, so he's suggesting that he be appointed as to do it. The Sangha agrees, yes you can. Then a party comes up and says, and he asks if the Sangha should appoint him as the Vinaya reciter, and then they say so be it. Again, this is classic Vinaya procedure, is appointing oneself in the Sangha, nominating oneself. Kāśyapa then questioned Upali, the Buddha was saying, in what place when he laid down the first precept, first parajika? Upali said, at Vesali. He further said, on whose behalf? On behalf of Sudina Kalandakaputta. He said, what was the grounds? He said, having sex with his former wife. Then he said, was there a second formulation? Yes, there was a bhikkhu having sex with a monkey. So this is great from the Sublime right down there. Yeah. So here, obviously, you know, you have a redaction of the Vinaya, which is very similar to the Pali. Okay, all of these details are found exactly the same way in the Pali. Remember, we're reading from the Mahiṣāsaka Vinaya, which was taken from Sri Lanka by Fa Siang in about 400-something CE, taken to China and translated. Now, this... however, other Vinayas have different things here. Okay, so this is one of the things, is that because what it does is it gives you the detail of a certain text and a summary of it, okay? It's establishing that particular text as the canonical one, right? So this is saying that particular Vinaya, which the text which starts out as our Vinaya starts out like this, that was the one that was recited at the first council. And of course all of the schools did that, and it's not always the same. In this case, of course, this is the same as the Pali. And so it could well have been a Pali or any, but in many cases they're not the same. So each school says that its own canon was redacted at the first council. Okay? But in each case the details are different. Alright? Then second precept. they'd done at Radhikaha, on whose behalf Dhaniya was the ground, stealing Bimbisara's timbers, again the same as the Pali. When was the third precept laid down at Vesali, on whose behalf, on behalf of many bhikkhus, was the ground answered, taking the life of oneself and others, again exactly the same as the Pali. Whereas the fourth precept laid down at Vesali, on whose behalf, on behalf of the Vagamuda bhikkhus, on what grounds, vainly boasting of superhuman dhammas. So all of those four parajikas have the same backgrounds and the same details in the Mihishasika and the Pali. They're very closely related schools. Okay. So interesting to notice that we've been looking at the Bhikkhuni Vinaya, and all of the Parajikas and all of the Sanghadisesas are different in all of the Vinayas. The background stories and everything are different for those, whereas here with the Bhikkhus precepts, then seems there's a lot more consistency. Okay, then the question in the midst of the Bhikkhus, and the Sangha said, this is the Bhikkhu Vinaya, this is the Bhikkhuni Vinaya. Together this is called the Vinaya Pitaka, and they do refer to the both Vinayas. Okay, now I'm going to question Venerable Ananda regarding the suttas. Now, in some cases, Venerable Ananda made quite a dramatic entrance. I think he flew through the keyhole and things like that in some versions. But here he just seems to have walked in by more regular means. If the Sangha is ready, he's appointed. Where did the Buddha teach the Ekottara Sutta? So notice here, this is completely different from the Pali. Okay, so Ekottara Sutta, Dasutara Sutta, Mahanidana Sutta, Sangiti Sutta, Samanyapala Sutta, Brahmajala Sutta. Now these are all suttas from the Diga Nikaya, or Dirga Agama. Ekottara Sutta is not found in Pali, but probably a Diga Sutta, but these are all Diga Suttas, the Sutra, Mahanidana, and so on. So he's asking about the Diga Nikaya, but it's in a completely different sequence. In the Pali version, it starts out with the Brahmajala and then the Samanyapala Sutta. So here it deviates from the Pali. It's a different redaction of the canon which is being authorized here. Which suttas are taught to bhikkhus, which are taught to bhikkhunis, or laymen, lay women, male and female devas, Ananda answered all, and when he taught about that, he said, here the long suttas are collected in one part called the Dhirga Agama, those neither long nor short, in the Madhyama Agama, those taught to bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, lay women, male and female deities, and are collected and called the Sanyukta Agama. Those from one art dhamma up to 11 dhammas are now collected and called the Ekottara Agama. Miscellaneous teachings are now gathered in the Kudika Pitaka. This is called the Sutta Pitaka. So this is the system of the suttas according to the Mahishasaka. And as you can see, the general pattern of it is identical to the Pali, but the details of what's mentioned is somewhat different.
That would be a much later thing, wouldn't it? This whole idea of the long, short, and middle.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because like, in the time of the Buddha, the suttas were collected according to the nine angas, and so what you seem to have here is a process where that's been replaced by the Nikaya organization system. I think it's not implausible that the Nikaya or Agama system started at the first council, or at least certainly in the early period. It is common to all of the schools.
So it's consistent in this way.
Yeah. The pattern is consistent, but the details are always different. From this day on, we've now already gathered the Dhamma. What the Buddha has not established should not be mistakenly established. What is already established should not be deviated from. As the Buddha instructed, we should sincerely train. Then Ananda said to Kassapa, I personally heard it from the Buddha. After Parinibbana, it's wish I allow for the lesser and minor precepts to be rescinded. And all the monks said, oh, come on, we've just recited these things for a month, and now you tell us that we didn't have to bother with the lesser and minor rules. Kassapa said, do you know which ones are the lesser and minor rules? Ananda said, I don't know. Kassapa said, why? He says, oh, well, I didn't ask the Buddha. Why didn't you ask? The Buddha's body was in pain, so I didn't want to trouble him. Kassapa said, that is a wrongdoing for not asking. You should see your fault and confess. Ananda said, Venerable Sir, it was not out of disrespecting precepts that I didn't ask this question. I didn't wish to disturb the Buddha, so I didn't dare, so I don't see it as a fault, but out of faith in the Venerable, I confess. Kassapa again interrogated Ananda. When sowing the Buddha's sangha, you used your toes. This is wrongdoing. You should see your fault and confess.
It's an imagination, isn't it?
And Andy said, "Venerable sir, it's not out of respect, not out of friend, like that. But out of faith in the Venerable Lay Confessor."
He likes because he's suddenly
Yeah. Kassapa then interrogated. Kassapa again interrogated Ananda.
"Three times you begged the Buddha to allow the going forth for women in the Sadama. This is a wrongdoing. Well, you should see your fault and confess."
Ananda said, "Oh, you're right, actually, that was a big mistake." But, Ananda said, "Venerable sir, it was not out of disrespecting the Dharma, but Mahaprajapati raised the Blessed One till he was grown up and could go forth and achieve the great path." Okay, then Kassapa again interrogated Ananda. "Near the time of the Parinibbana, the Buddha hinted that one who developed the four bases of psychic power could, if they wished, live on for an eon or more. So he dropped a hint to you three times and you didn't beg him to live on." Ananda said, "Oh, it wasn't my fault. Mara, the evil one, had clouded my mind."
But with that previous paragraph, it seems a bit strange that in front of the Buddha, he's asking for the going forth three times for women.
Yeah.
But the Buddha agrees to it, consents.
Yeah.
Therefore, that's a rule, right? That's allowable.
Yeah.
And then you've got Kassapa saying it's wrongdoing.
Yeah.
After the Buddha's being personally involved in the process, Kassapa's saying it's wrongdoing for basically for the Buddha to have given the going forth.
Yeah.
It's a bit ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit dubious, yeah.
Is this the mark, I suppose, always trying to look something?
How did that fall, Ananda?
But this itself, I have a little, forgive me if I have a little bit of doubt on that. This seems a doubtful matter, a dubious representation of that event.
Well, out of my great compassion, I forgive you. Okay, Buddha asked you for water three times. This is an event that happened in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Ananda didn't give it. Ananda said, "Well, 500 carts had just crossed upstream. The water was muddy. I didn't want to get him, make him sick, so I didn't offer it." Kassapa, yes, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta.
Kassapa, I thought he went there, and the Buddha said it would be clear, just go. And he went and got the water anyway.
Eventually, yeah. But he refused first. Kassapa again interrogated Ananda. "You allowed women to first worship the Buddha's corpse. This is a wrongdoing." Ananda said, "Well, I didn't want to enable them to worship first, but the day was ending and I didn't want them to not be able to enter the city gate. That's why I allowed them." So of course this list of wrongdoings is reasonably consistent across the traditions, but not exactly the same. In some of the versions it goes into a lot more detail. In the Mahishasika version, for example, it says things like, if women hadn't been allowed the going forth, then the lay people would have had so much faith that they would have laid their hair on the road for the bhikkhus to walk on when they were going on alms. This is Kassapa talking. But now they're going to lose faith and so they're not going to do that. And Ananda says, "Oh, I'm sorry, that's such a terrible thing I've done."
Why in the first half of the getting out of what the Buddha said and everything, how come Mahakasapa suddenly do this interrogation?
Well, this is why it's just a very strange procedure, yeah. It's been sort of instituted partly as a vinaya matter. Now, even though the actual particular things that he's being criticized for are not actually vinaya problems, right? None of them are actually vinaya offenses at all, but he's still being criticized for them. So it's this kind of strange sort of conjunction of what we would imagine the council would be for, and then these sort of quite strange disciplinary procedures. Yeah. I mean, how it's usually interpreted, it can be interpreted on many levels. But one way of interpreting it is that this is like a record or an indication of certain tensions that were growing within the Sangha after the Buddha passed away. And so there were different monks, had different perspectives and so on. So this is kind of a memory in some way of what was happening there. So it's not necessarily that you take it literally as this is exactly what was happening, but more that yeah, it's sort of an indication of certain tendencies that are emerging within this. But you know, there's no, you know, it's quite possible that Kassapa and Ananda did have some, you know, personal problems. Okay.
They needed some dialogue.
Okay, so he, Kassapa then interrogated Ananda, and they asked, they couldn't figure out which of the rules were lesser and minor. So basically, then they agreed that they would keep them all. Okay. Okay, now, then this bit is an interesting bit, and this is one of the most interesting parts of the Mahishasika version, particularly. At that time, the Thera Purana was living in the southern districts, Dakshinagiri. He heard that the Buddha passed away in Kusinara, and the elder bhikkhus had gathered in Rajagaha to recite the Vinaya Dhamma. Like a strong man would bend his arm, he and his followers appeared in the assembly and said to Ananda Kassapa, that means he vanished and appeared with his psychic powers, I hear that the Buddha has passed away and the elder bhikkhus have gathered in Rajagaha to recite the Vinaya Dhamma. Is this true? Kassapa said, Venerable Sir, it's true. Purana said, please repeat that recitation. They said, you've got to be kidding. Kassapa recited the recitation as above. Now, what in this episode with Purana is mentioned in every Vinaya, I think, or certainly in most of them. But usually he just says, well, whatever the Sangha's recited is well recited, but I'll remember the Buddha's teachings as I heard them from him himself.
Is that the Pali version?
That's in the Pali version, yeah, and that's fairly consistent.
Now, this is the monk Purana who was living, when they say southern districts, Sri Lanka, and he was crossing the
island. No. Sri Lanka doesn't come into the picture for another 200 years.
Well, I remember reading something where the Sri Lankan bhikkhu went across to India and shortened the gap to the island and lots of stuff. So, not this guy.
Okay, so this Mahishasika is the only Vinaya that actually gives some details as to what the difference was. Okay, so you've got this thing where Purana has suddenly decided to keep his own version of Buddhism, right? And so, of course, it's very interesting why he was like, well, what were the differences? Why? How did he remember things? And so this is the only one that actually lists the differences which Purana had and what he objected to. When recited, Purana said to Kassapa, I personally heard it from the Buddha, and then he's got these seven factors, which are just mentioned it's just like one or two characters in the Chinese. And so this is a kind of a translation of it. Storing food indoors, cooking oneself taking food to have another person offer, oneself pick up fruit to eat, receiving from pond water, when there was no one to make allowable, eating allowable fruit after ejecting seeds. So obviously all of these rules have to do with the etiquette around eating and the rules around eating. Kassapa said, Venerable Sir, these seven items were temporarily allowed by the Buddha while staying at Vaisali during a time of famine when alms food was hard to come by. He immediately rescinded four, and when he returned to Savatthi, he rescinded the remaining three. Purana said the Blessed One would not allow what was already restricted or restrict what was already allowed, which of course is by no means the case. It's constantly happening in the Vinaya. Kassapa said the Buddha is the Lord of Dhamma. He dwells in mastery of Dhamma. If he were to allow what was already restricted or restrict what was already allowed, what blame could there be? Purana said, I accept these extra reasons regarding these seven items and am not able to practice them.
Is that confusing with this? Confusing with the other monk. Trying to think. It happened at the time the Buddha, that monk appears. I think he's from the north. Who the precious Lichavis? Are the Lichavis the precious ones with the blue chariot?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the monk says, I can't practice. He comes to the Buddha and says, I cannot practice these 150 mm-hmm. precepts as recited. And the Buddha says, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
You practice by sila, practice by samadhi.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is that a confusion of these two stories?
No, it's completely different.
It seems to be saying the same sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a completely different context. Though. There's plenty of places where people say they can't practice the rules.
Mm.
There's several places in the Majjhima Nikaya as well. Anyway, so we have these seven rules, seven items. And the interesting thing about this is that it sounds to me so reasonable that you know, Purana says, staying with the Buddha, the Buddha lays down some rules. Purana goes off to the southern districts, and then meanwhile, Lavinia is changing. The Buddha changes some things while he's away because conditions change, and then he's not aware of it. Yeah? So it seems to me that this kind of thing must have been going on all the time. Yeah? The Lavinia was in a constant state of evolution during the Buddha's life, and it would have been almost impossible for all of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis in the different regions to remain up to date with everything. So this is obviously one of the purposes of the council, was to standardize these things. But yeah, I mean, Purana's position seems to be quite straightforward. But he says, interestingly, he says he's not able to practice them. Perhaps why? We can only speculate that perhaps because of the conditions where he's living in the southern regions. Perhaps they needed to store up food in the monastery. Maybe they couldn't get such food, good food on alms or something like that. It's not immediately clear what all of these are, but most of them are pretty seem to be pretty understandable in terms of the vinaya. But anyway, what's most noteworthy about this is that if we there's been in certain circles some speculation about what was the, you know, is this kind of conspiracy theories about Purana and you know, he got the real Dhamma or something like that, and it's the quite a lot of speculation about what it was, but this is the only ancient source which actually gives us some hint as to what it may be, and it's only a dispute about some minor details of Vinaya. There's no major principles at stake here.
From your reading, Bhattacharya, have you ever seen any place where the Buddha says that you should hold a council after my death to anyone?
Yep.
He does say this, you should hold council?
Yep.
Where is that?
In Sangiti Sutta, Dasudra Sutta, some two or three suttas in the Majjhimanikaya.
Previous death, he says, monks, you should gather council.
Yep.
All right.
Kassapa then said, okay, what Buddha is not established, we should not mistakenly establish. What is already established should not be deviated from. As the Buddha instructed, we should sincerely train. So we didn't translate the rest of it, but then it says, recite the episode about the punishment and rehabilitation of the Bhikkhu Channa. This is one of the things which the Buddha said on his deathbed. I allow the Brahmadanda, the supreme punishment for the Bhikkhu Channa. This was given to a task to Ananda to perform, and Pali goes into some detail. The Mahishasaka version is much quicker. And then it has this interesting little bit which is not found in the Pali, and it tells you actually who was there and who sat in what seat. So Anya Kondanya sat in the elder seat, the oldest bhikkhu there. So apparently he doesn't appear anywhere else in the suttas. So here he makes his reappearance. It's a bit like
saw the light.
One and the same. Yeah. He comes back. It's a bit like Paul and Ringo having a revival. Okay, and you come down there. Purama sat in the second seat. And then Tanmi, who's Tanmi, probably Dhamma something. Don't know who Tanmi is, that's why we didn't translate it. Torba. Thanks, King, that's good. Kassapa, so one of the Kassapas sat in the fourth seat. Baddha Kassapa. These are possibly the Kassapas from the Kassapa brothers who converted very early, and then Mahakassapa sat in the sixth seat. So he wasn't, according to Mihishasaka anyway, Kassapa wasn't the elder monk, but he still ran everything. Upali sat in the seventh, and Anuruddha sat in the eighth. That's a bit unlikely, because both Upali and Anuruddha went forth with Ananda, would have been 20, 25 years after the Buddha became enlightened. 500 arahants, neither more nor less. That's why it's called the 500 Gathering Dhamma. Okay, so there's a Mahishasaka version of the first council, and of course, endless details differ between the different versions. But it's generally agreed that there was a council or a gathering of some kind, but opinions of the scholars differ as to the plausibility of different aspects of how the council is presented. Okay. I should mention, I mean, the reason I brought this up, this is History of Indian Buddhism by Etienne Lamotte, yeah? And this is the absolute classic of modern Buddhist studies and the history of Buddhism, and chock-a-block full of footnotes in like really small fonts and things like that. And so this is a terrific, this is probably the most influential book in modern Buddhist studies, as referred to by everyone. So he gives extremely comprehensive references to everything, and so almost any, if you want to know about any historical thing that's happening in Buddhism, especially the early period, just first, Lamotte is your first point of call. Yeah, so you just check it up in Lamotte, and he'll give you all the references, and then if you can find the canonical sources from there and go and read them. He's better at his references than he is at his analysis, so you often might find that, you know, you're not necessarily persuaded by the conclusions that he draws, but in terms of actually assembling all of the information, translating masses of things that are not found elsewhere and so on, then it's extremely useful. Oh, look, I'm sure you could get it on Amazon. Yeah. Oh, good idea. Classic, written in, Lamotte was Belgian. Written in French, translated into English. Okay, so after the first council, we don't know much about what happened after that. So we've, in the canon, we've just got the account of the first council, we've got a gap of 100 years, and then we've got the account of the second council. And we don't know all that much about what happened in between. We've got lists of kings that come from the Sri Lankan sources, whether they're historical or not, no one really knows. We have legendary accounts. The accounts tell us that the Kassapa remained as the leader of Buddhism for 20 years, and then following that, Ananda took over the job for a following 20 years. Okay, and then following Ananda, we have an interesting thing is the list of the. I should have just noticed that in here. The list of the masters of the Dhamma. And I should he was a good generation younger than the Buddha, so he would have been perhaps 50 in his 40s, perhaps probably in his 40s. Yeah, so he lived for another 40 years after that. Where are we going here? This is, okay, here we go. This is confused here. I'm not sure this is on, should be. One of the important things about the early Buddhist history is the succession of masters, and we have various lists of leaders of Buddhism, and we have one in the Southern School. The Sinhalese canon gives us a list of teachers from the time of the Buddha, found in the Parivara. The first, and this is Vinaya leaders, the Vinaya Pamokas. The first one, Uttari, who recited the Vinaya in the first council. The second one, Dasaka. Third one, Sonaka. Then Siddhava. And then Moggaliputta in the time of King Ashoka, the most important one. And following Moggaliputta, then Mahinda. Okay. Now the Sanskrit sources, on the other hand, give a different list of the masters of Dhamma, or different lists of the masters of Dhamma. And this refers to the Dhamma rather than the Vinaya masters. Now, the Sanskrit masters are Kassapa, is the first one. And so Kassapa is obviously great importance, especially for Mahayana Buddhism and for the Chinese tradition and so on. as the first lineage holder, Kassapa, and then Ananda. And then the third one is Shanakavasin. And Shanakavasin, or Shanavasin, is one of the leaders at the time of the Second Council. And even though he's regarded as a lineage master in the northern traditions, he's also found in the Pali Vinaya. So he's not a sectarian figure. He's found in all of the Vinayas. Shanaka may be the same as the Sonaka, who is found in the Pali list. I think he probably is, but anyway. Shanakavasin, and then following him, then Upagupta. So you have these five lineage masters in the northern sources, mentioned many, many places. So first is Kassapa, Ananda. Oh, then you have, means the wearer of hemp cloth. He wore his robes were made of hemp, you know, like a kind of rice sack kind of material. Upagupta. And then probably in between here is probably Madhyandika. Okay. And No, Kassapa and Ananda were. These guys weren't. Now, Madhyandika is actually almost certainly a mistake. That's why I put him in things. He actually belongs down here, or is more or less contemporary with Upagupta, probably. That's being shifted to an earlier point. But this is the lineage that's actually given, and that takes us up to the time of Ashoka. Okay, so Upagupta was regarded as one of the teachers in the time of Ashoka. So this is the lineage between them, those five. And this was a list of masters which was very current in the northern schools, especially around Mathura. And we find this constantly met with. Okay, but the one of the critical things here is that Shanakavasin is mentioned in all of the schools as being one of the leaders. So it shows he wasn't a sectarian figure. That's one of the key points in sects and sectarianism when I was writing that. So obviously during that period there were some historical shifts, there was a development of Buddhism. We don't know much about the details, we can only infer from what's actually happened later on. It seems that Magadha was continuing to expand, was gradually absorbing the nations around it. Buddhism was gradually spreading out to more remote regions, perhaps Mathura, a bit further south and so on, but still hadn't like really spread. That remained for the time of King Ashoka. Okay, so the next major event happened was the Second Council. Vardhana Council, the Second Council. Translated version of this. But I won't go into too much detail into the Second Council. You can read it in the Pali translation. The Second Buddhist Council took place in Vesali about 100 years after the Buddha's Parinibbana in order to settle a serious dispute on Vinaya. The Orthodox monks were able to convince the monks whose behaviour was under question. Accounts of the dispute are preserved in the Vinaya texts of several of the early Buddhist schools, all of the early Buddhist schools in fact. Virtually all scholars agree that this Second Council was a historical event. And you get this kind of impression, like if you arrange the historical Buddhist scriptures on a line, you start out with the Buddha's birth, then his enlightenment and the period after his enlightenment, and then the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and the First Council and the Second Council. If you put all of those texts on a line, what you can see is that they actually quite consistently disappear into the mist. So the further you go back in time, the more vague they become, the less concrete details they have, the less vivid they become, and the more kind of miracles and so on. So like the birth narrative is almost entirely legendary and miraculous, but hardly any history in it at all. Enlightenment story has got some history, but not so much. Then the Mahaparinibbana, you get these very vivid details of like the Buddha sitting, warming his back in the sun, and the Ananda commenting on the wrinkles he has in his back, and these kinds of things, which sound very kind of personal, lifelike details. And then the First Council and Second Council, again, is sort of sounding much more like journalism and much less like legendary myth-making. And so that kind of suggests that you've got an actual point of focus, which is somewhere here, you know, not long after the Second Council. And so the versions of the Second Council we have are much clearer in memory to the people who are doing the redaction. Okay, it's not to say that they're, you know, completely in agreement or anything, but just a sort of general tone of it. Some time after the Second Council, schisms occurred within the monastic Sangha, which resulted in the formation of several subgroups such as Saviravada, Sacharavada, Mahasangika, and Sarvasivada. I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. Okay, specific 10, that shouldn't be in there actually. See, this is two Buddhist councils counting the opening of the sixth group. What's that? Actually should be deleted. It's got the Second Council. There's this association of schism with the Second Council. Okay, almost every historical account you'll read will associate the schisms in some way with the Second Council. And that entire thing, which completely dominates all modern Buddhist academic work on the matter, is entirely based on one clearly fictitious and incorrect passage in the Dīpavamsa of the Sri Lankan Chronicle Dīpavamsa. Nothing, there's not another shred of evidence anywhere that links the Second Council with schism. And it's that one passage in the Dīpavamsa which is should really be deleted. I wish it was easy to delete as the Wikipedia was. Anyway, the dispute arose over the 10 points. Okay, claims of some monks broken 10 rules. Storing salt in a horn, that means you keep salt so you can salt your meal, so you keep the salt forever and you put it on your meal which is offered. Eating after midday, eating once and then going again to village for alms. Upholding the upasaka ceremony with monks dwelling in the same locality. Carrying out official acts when the assembly was incomplete. Following a certain practice because it was done by one's tutor or teacher. This is one of the most important ones. Acharya Makapika Vada. Okay. Of course, this being the almost universally found today that things are done because that's how it's done by accepted custom, whereas the Second Council decided clearly that was not justified. And interestingly enough, that King Mongkut, or Prince Mongkut, when he was in the Sangha, constantly referred to this idea of Acharya Makapika Vada and was totally critical of contemporary Thai Buddhism, because they just followed along with their own customs without reference to what was actually taught by the Buddha. Eating sour milk after one's had his midday meal, consuming strong milk drink before it's been fermented, so that's like it's on the edge of being fermented, can you drink it? Using a rug that's not the proper size, maybe. Using gold and silver. Okay, so the main issue was using gold and silver or using money. All of these others, there's a list of 10 found in all the vineyards, and they have some things in common, but it's not easy to work out exactly what all of them mean.
None of this would seem to be a valid reason for a schism anyway.
Yeah, yes.
It's all pretty, depending on how you view it,
that's right.
Minor.
Yeah. Okay, so the key issue was the use of gold and silver. The monks of Vesali had taken to wandering for alms with the specific goal of collecting money, to which the visiting monk Yasa objected. Some of the other points are also important. For example, point number 6, which would allow monks to not follow the vineyard, or any point which the teacher did not follow or practice. Okay, controversy. Okay, so they called... It's very interesting to read the narrative of the Second Council, just the different politics that were going on. They would go and visit, like the monks, they sort of gathered all the monks from the different areas to come and go to Vesali. Because all the monks in Vesali sort of formed a faction, or most of them, so they had to sort of go around and get all the monks from the different regions to come so that they could outnumber the local monks. And then they were sort of paying all these kind of nighttime visits, and all the different parties were visiting the leaders of the opposite factions, and the Vajiputikas were sort of visiting the leaders of the other side and saying, oh, maybe Venerable, maybe you'd like this nice new robe we've got to offer, and you know, please accept this out of our kindness of our heart, and maybe you'd consider our little viewpoint and when the council's coming up. And then another one, then they visit them and they sit and they sit in meditation together. And they have, so it's very nice little personal details here. And there's sort of that one where they tried to bribe the senior monk, and he said he wouldn't have anything to do with it. So they said, oh, well, often Ananda would accept the gifts which the Buddha might refuse. So we'll see this monk's attendant. We'll see if we can bribe him instead, yeah? So they went and they managed to bribe the attendant. And then so all this kind of quite realistic kind of politicking that's going around in the background. And yeah. It is, yeah. It's Bob Hawke's version of consensus, yeah. And when they did the council, they said that they couldn't come to any agreement, and the discussion was just out of control, so they appointed a committee of 10 with 5 from each side, so 5 from the local Vajiputika monks and 5 from the visiting monks, they call the Paveyaka, or the outsider monks, they call Paveyaka. And but what they'd done is, in their visiting the monks beforehand, they'd actually made sure that one or two of the Vajiputika monks were going to vote on their side. Yeah? So they already stacked the books before the council was elected, or the committee was elected, yeah. So they got the elected committee, 10 of them, and then they all agreed. And they referred back to the Vinaya texts, as found in the Vinaya today.
The Vinaya actually has that process in it, doesn't it?
That's right.
But the person who actually starts the voting process has to know that the side of Dhamma is going to win.
There's something like that, yeah, but it's not... I'm not sure about whether they were following the Vinaya or whether the Vinaya is following them.
Yeah, where does that particular thing come from?
Yeah.
Is it written after the fact that Dhamma was power broking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. So. Anyway, so that's the second council, all right? Now. There's no mention in most of the canons, certainly in the Pali, there's no mention of recitation of the Dhamma or of any other business. Okay? It was just a discussion on these Vinaya points. Okay? And hence it's the last book of the Khandakas. Did they recite the Dhamma as well? No, quite likely they did. Later versions say that they did, later accounts say that they did, but you know, it's hard to establish. So, in any case, that's the second council. But all versions say that the Sangha came to unanimity at the end of the second council. All right. So, there's no justification for associating the Vajiputikas, the dissenting monks in the second council, with the Mahasanghika school, which is what's done in most histories. All right. Okay, so after the second council, and the second council, around about the time of the second council, we already mentioned that around the time of the second council was about the time of Alexander in the West invading India, and he sort of came into India, and his troops were rebelling. At that time, the Mauryan and Magadhan empires were very strong. They had massive. They had a Greek ambassador, Megasthenes, in the court of King Chandragupta. Was about this time, and he gave these reports of the kind of the massive military forces that were at the disposal of the Indian emperors at that time, including, I think, thousands or tens of thousands of elephants. So when Alexander arrived with his exhausted armies all the way from Greece, they kind of thought that India that only kind of went as far as basically Pakistan and the Indus Valley, and they sort of crossed over, and then they sort of asking people, you know, how far does India go? They thought they conquered India, yeah. And they said, oh, thousands of miles yet to go, and there's all these great empires. And then the soldiers starting to mutter among themselves, and Alexander's starting to say, okay, guys, let's go for it. So that's when they kind of turned back, and very soon afterwards Alexander got ill and died. But they did establish kingdoms there, so the northwest of India from this time there was under the control of Greek Bactrian kingdoms, not all of it and not all of the time, but there was that presence there for several hundred years. So Chandragupta, again around about this time, was the founder of the Mauryan dynasty, Chandragupta, according to the legends, was a like an outcast or from a village of thieves or a very low born, and then sort of by means of his sort of skill and manipulating people and so on, became the emperor and greatly expanded the Magadhan Empire. And because this region being more or less the region of old Buddhism, and around the Ganges, and by that time, by the time of Chandragupta, sort of the Magadhan Empire was probably something like that. So it's already a very large empire in the northern India. And then he had a couple of descendants. I can't remember the names of his descendants. And then King Ashoka. I think he was... King Ashoka was his grandson. So it was Chandragupta, and then I'm not sure who his son was. And King Ashoka, Dharmashoka. Somewhat confusingly enough, the king at the time of the second council is sometimes known as Kala Ashoka, is Black Ashoka, and Dharma Ashoka. There's some confusion between the two of them, whether they were two kings or just one, or whether there's been names being shifted over or whatever. So Ashoka came to power and expanded the realm of India to something like that. All right. So Ashoka's realm was huge. Okay, so you've gone within a few generations from the Magadhan Empire here, in the time of the Buddha, something like that would have been Magadha. And now you've got Magadha, the Indian Empire, ruled from Magadha, something like that. Okay, so when we move into the time of Ashoka, we've got sort of bit of refreshing clarity. We've got some actual physical things, and that's the first time we've got physical things, just about. Apart from a few scraps and bits and pieces, there's no physical remnants of anything that I've just been talking about.
It's all oral tradition.
It's all oral tradition, yeah. So here we have some Ashokan's stupas and edicts. So here's a picture of an Ashokan edict, and the character is called Ashokan Brahmi, and his first substantial texts that we have from ancient India. There's a few scraps of writing that come a bit earlier. Actually, the earliest writing from in the Indic region now is in Sri Lanka, about 450 something BC, and around the same time or similar time in India. There's a few bits of pottery with a couple of inscriptions on them. Anyway, shows that they did have writing, but the Ashokan edicts are the first actual serious stuff. This is a six-pillar edict. And that writing system, Ashokan Brahmi, is the ancestor of all of the writing systems in India, up to Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos. Okay, so that whole region, and Tibet as well, was descended, and it's a phonetic system. In the time of Ashoka, it was still not perfected. They couldn't represent entirely perfectly each phonetic element, but very soon it became basically a perfect phonetic alphabet. So all Indian writing is perfectly phonetic, so it's pronounced exactly as it's written. And if you know, just like when we're doing our Pali chanting, if we know what the Pali chanting is, we can pronounce it perfectly. Okay?
And that's where Sanskrit is also from that basis. Sanskrit comes from that sort of thing as well. That's the root form.
No, this is a writing script. Sanskrit's a language.
But how does Sanskrit represent in textual?
Any kind of writing script of the local region.
So it's transformed from a phonetic to a whatever sort of...
No, it's an oral language which is written in whatever the local script is of the local region.
So it's like Pali.
It's like Pali or English or whatever, yeah. Yeah.
Just a question.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does that mean?
Oh. Edicts. Edicts. Oh, what does edict mean? Yeah, something like that. Define edict.
Define.
Yeah, something like that. Edict from, I guess it's dict, isn't it?
Rule.
Dictation.
Proclamation.
formal or authoritative proclamation, decree, a leading binding command or decision entered on the court record as if issued by court or judge. So, the edicts of King Ashoka, a collection of 33 inscriptions on the pillars of Ashoka, as well as boulders and cave walls made by the Emperor Ashoka of the Mauryan dynasty during his reign from 272 to 231 BC. These inscriptions are dispersed throughout the areas of modern-day Pakistan and India. So here we can see the distribution of them. And represent the first tangible evidence of Buddhism. The edicts describe in detail the first wide expansion of Buddhism through the sponsorship of one of the most powerful kings of Indian history. According to the edicts, the extent of Buddhist proselytization through this period reached as far as the Mediterranean. He said, in fact, that he'd converted all the Greeks to Buddhism, or to Dharma anyway, and many Buddhist monuments were created. These inscriptions proclaim Ashoka's belief in the Buddhist concept of Dharma and his efforts to develop the Dharma throughout his kingdom. Where Buddhism and the Buddha are mentioned, the edicts of Ashoka tend to focus on social and moral precepts rather than religious practices. No mention is made of the philosophical dimension of Buddhism, such as the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path, okay, which is not unprecedented. It's a royal edict, not a teaching for monastics. But in these inscriptions, Ashoka refers to himself as beloved of the gods, Priyadarshi. This identification of King Priyadarshi with Ashoka was confirmed in an inscription discovered in 1915. The inscriptions, so we have all these, we've got these two sources of information on Ashoka. One is his own inscriptions, the other is the legends written about him, which we have one whole set of legends in Pali tradition, in the Sri Lankan tradition, and their whole realms of legends in Tibetan and Chinese and the Sanskrit literature. Yeah? Thousands of stories about King Ashoka talking with these monks and blah, blah, blah. A lot of material, and of course most of it is very legendary, and it was a great finding. One of the root findings of modern Buddhist studies was, and Indic history, was to be able to identify the Ashoka found within all of these Buddhist scriptures and within Hindu scriptures and I think Jaina as well. To find him, to actually identify him with the author of these edicts. Okay? And one of the things, of course, we found is that when the two sources were compared, that you found two quite different men in the two things. And in the Buddhist scriptures, he tends to be quite a dogmatic Buddhist who's supporting Buddhism to the exclusion of everybody else. And his main interest seems to be giving lots of really nice stuff to the monks. And in King Ashoka's own edicts, he hardly mentions Buddhism at all. He does in a few places. He refers to some scriptures and to some things, but mostly he's interested in Dharma, and he supports all religions, doesn't just support Buddhism. The inscriptions found in the eastern part of India were written in the Magadhi language using the Brahmi script, such as this one. And in the western part of India, the language used is closer to Sanskrit, using the Kharoshthi script. One extract of Edict 13 in Greek, and one bilingual edict in Greek and Aramaic. Okay, and these were decodified by British archaeologist and historian James Prinsep. Inscriptions revolve around a few repetitive themes: Ashoka's conversion to Buddhism, the description of his efforts to spread Buddhism, his moral and religious precepts, and his social and animal welfare program. Ashoka, so here's some fragments of his edicts. So very fascinating to read his own words. One of the interesting things about the edicts and the texts on there is that they're not particularly good. They're not polished, refined language. It feels like the dictation of Ashoka himself. Yeah, there was a court scribe who was actually writing down his words as they were spoken, rather than being a really polished literary tract. Beloved of the gods, King Priyadarshi conquered the Kalingas 8 years after his coronation. 150,000 were deported, 100,000 were killed, and many more died from other causes. After the Kalingas had been conquered, beloved of the gods came to feel a strong inclination for the Dhamma, a love for the Dhamma and instruction in Dhamma. Now, beloved of the gods feels deep remorse for having conquered the Kalingas. So this is this very moving statement where he says sorry.
You don't see that a lot in a lot of conquering epics, do you?
No.
Like the kings just thought, oh, it was such a nice idea at the time.
Yeah. Following his conversion, Ashoka travelled throughout India and visited sacred Buddhist locations where he would typically erect a pillar bearing his inscriptions. 20 years after his coronation, beloved of the gods, King Piyadasi visited this place and worshipped because here was the Buddha, the sage of the Sakyans, was born. Iha Buddhe Jate. He had a stone figure and a pillar set up, and because the Lord was born here, the village of Lumbini was exempted from tax and required to pay only 1/8 of the produce. Okay, in order to propagate the Buddhist faith, or to propagate Dhamma anyway, whether that means Buddhism, is a bit controversial. He names the various rulers of the time, inheritors of the Bactrian kingdoms, Greek kingdoms, by conquest of Dhamma, Dharma Vijaya, the beloved of the gods, considers to be the best conquest, and it is conquest by Dhamma that has been won here. And notice how very Dhammapadic Ashoka's Dhamma is. Yeah, and you have exactly the same idea in the Dhammapada. Yeah, the Dhamma, victory of Dhamma is the best Dhamma. Better to win, conquer oneself than it is to conquer by the sword 1,000 men or something like that. And so that kind of Dhammapada style Dhamma is very closely associated with Ashoka. Conquest by Dhamma has been won here on the borders, even 600 yojanas away, where the Greek king Antiochus rules. Beyond there are four kings named Ptolemy and Antigonus, Magus and Alexander. Likewise, in the south among the Cholas, Pandyas, and as far as Tamraparni, this being Sri Lanka.
This gives you an idea of how far a yojana might be.
Yeah, 600 carts. So this is as far as his political knowledge is. And remembering that in the time of the Buddha and in the suttas, political knowledge extended about this far. Right? No mention of southern India in the suttas. No, it goes up to Gandhara, so we've got up to here. No mention even of these areas down here. Only around here. And now we're going all that way. Okay. Okay, so 600 yojanas, distance between India and Greece, 4,000 miles. And so here's the identification of people referred to in the edicts with the known kings. Okay, so there are, as it's disputed about to what extent there was actual proselytization or whatever that actually happened. But anyway, it's an interesting topic. Okay. And he was obviously a positive thinker. Here in the king's domain, among the Greeks, Cambodgians, Nabakas, Nabapandits, Bodhis, Bidinikas, Andas, and Palidas, everywhere, people are following the beloved of the gods' instructions in Dharma. It's a very optimistic kind of viewpoint. Okay, so there are aspect of Greek society mentioned in the edict. There's no country except among the Greeks where these two groups, Brahmins and ascetics, are not found, and there is no country where people are not devoted to one or other religion. Interesting little remark there. And so this is from his Kandahar edict, where he used the Greek term Eusebeia for Dharma. What does that mean? Eusebeia. Meaning well and reverence. It means sacred. Inner piety, spiritual maturity, or godliness. Personal piety. Interesting. It's interesting that you have this translated as godliness. Cleanliness is next to godliness. Cleanliness is next to Dharma. Anyway, where are we? Okay, edicts. Bilingual inscription. Okay. He is beloved of the gods and regards everyone amiably, made known the doctrine of piety or Dharma to men, and from this moment he has made men more pious, and everyone thrives throughout the whole world. And the king, he sounds a bit like Barack Obama, doesn't it? And the king abstains from killing living beings and other men and those who are huntsmen. And fishermen of the king have desisted from hunting. And if some were intemperate, they have ceased from their intemperance as was in their power and obedient to their mother and father and to the elders in opposition to the past, also in the future. And so acting on every occasion, they will live better and more happily. So, dharma is good. What constitutes dharma? Little evil, much good, kindliness, generosity, truthfulness and purity. Noble deeds of dharma and practice of dharma consist in having kindness, generosity, truthfulness, purity, gentleness and goodness increase among the people. It is my desire that there should be uniformity in law and uniformity in sentencing. I even go this far to grant a 3-day stay for those in prison who have been tried and sentenced to death. During this time, their relatives can make appeals, have the prisoners' lives spared if there's none to appeal on their behalf. The prisoners can give gifts in order to make merit for the next world or to observe fasts. In the 26 years since my coronation, prisoners have been given amnesty on 25 occasions.
Okay. So it's like nearly 1 year.
Yeah, and so this, you know, amazing to see, you know, you see in the accounts in the suttas how brutal the punishments were in the ancient India. And to see this kind of gentleness expressed, he did actually at one point he did actually abolish capital punishment.
Do you think that may have given rise to the idea of the governor's pardon, the sort of idea that you just give someone,
yeah,
like in even Jesus, the Romans turn up and say, you know, yeah, you've got Barabbas here, you've got Jesus, who you want to set free from you?
Yeah, I'm sure it probably was an older tradition. Yeah. Inherited that thing. I mean, they still do it in America, don't they? 26 years after my coronation, various animals were declared to be protected. Parrots, miners, I don't know, ruddy grease, wild ducks, nandi mukas, delicates, we don't know what all of them, bats, queen ants, terrapins, boneless fish, ganga puputaka, we don't know what all these are, fish, tortoises, porcupines, squirrels, deer, bulls, wild asses, wild pigeons, domestic pigeons, and all four-footed creatures that are neither useful nor edible. Those nanny goats, ewes, and sows, which are with young or giving milk to the young, are protected, and so are young ones less than 6 months old. Cocks are not to be caponized. I don't know what that means. Husks hiding living things are not to be burnt, and forests are not to be burnt either without reason or to kill creatures. One animal is not to be fed to another. Quite extraordinary, isn't it? Okay, just precepts. Piyadasi, king of Magadha, saluting the Sangha and wishing them good health and happiness, speaks thus. You know, reverend sirs, how great my faith has been in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. Whatever, venerable sirs, has been spoken by the Lord Buddha, all that is well spoken. These Dhamma texts extracts from the discipline, noble way of life, the fears to come, the poem on the silent sage, the discourse on the pure life, Upatissa's questions and the advice of Brahula, which is spoken by the Buddha concerning false speech. These Dhamma texts, reverend sirs, I desire that all the monks and nuns may constantly listen to and remember, likewise the laymen and laywomen. So it's very interesting. So here we have the first physical evidence of a reference to actual Buddhist texts. And these are all suttas which are more or less found within the Pali canon. The exact identification of some of them is very clear. For example, the Rahulavada, advice of Rahula spoken concerning false speech. This is one of the Rahulavada suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, which does indeed concern false speech. The fears to come is in Anagata Bhayani, is some suttas found in the Anguttara Nikaya. Others, it's not entirely clear which sutta exactly is being spoken to. For example, Upatissa's questions, Upatissa being Sariputta, and of course he asked many questions in the sutta, so it could be in a number of different ones. Nevertheless, it's definitely agreed that all of these are the kind of things which we find in the suttas and Vinaya, mainly the suttas today. So there's no question that, you know, he's something completely different. It's obviously the same, more or less the same as the text we find in the Agama Nikayas and Nikayas these days. And also notice that he's always speaks of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis and also mentions the laymen and laywomen that they should be studying the Dhamma. He's not just addressing the bhikkhus. Belief in the next world. Okay, so the idea that one should give for the sake of the next world. Far from being sectarian, Ashoka, based on a belief that all religions shared a common positive essence, encouraged tolerance and understanding of other religions. All religions should reside everywhere, for all of them desire self-control and purity of heart. Here in my domain, no living beings are to be slaughtered or offered in sacrifice. I mean, that's quite stunning to say in India. I mean, crikey, you've had thousands of years, the whole Vedic tradition. Contact between religions is good. One should listen to and respect the doctrines professed by others. Beloved of the gods, King Priyadasi desires that all should be well learned in the good doctrines of other religions.
How would that have contrasted with Brahmanical faith? That would have been in direct opposition to Brahmanical faith. The not slaughtering or...
Oh, yeah.
He would have been possibly changing that.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of enemies, yeah.
So, now the Hindus are vegetarians, so...
Yeah, they often think that the...
It's like Christians were saying about these things, that Christians and Muslims eat meat, but...
Okay, yeah.
Well, at least in South India,
they
wouldn't touch even eggs.
It's often felt that King Ashoka was a great influence in that. Yeah, there's precious little evidence of vegetarianism before. There's a few mentions to it in the suttas, so it clearly was an idea that was around, but it wasn't so widespread.
Yep. The whole concept of that Friday Lent thing comes from here too. Not eating red meat on Friday during Lent.
No, that comes from Judaism.
Yeah, but where does that come from? That's like some guy gets converted on the cross and now you can stop eating meat on Friday. For what reason?
I think that's from the ancient rules of the Torah.
Really? Because that's what the thing is?
It's quite common that most religions have periods of fasting or restriction in diet for one reason or another. So, interesting that he said elsewhere that one never advances one's own religion by criticizing religions of others, but one only improves one's own religion by praising and supporting religions of others. One of the most fascinating things about Ashoka is the combination of obviously very deep religious faith and interesting religion, but also his presentation of things and his ethics is entirely secular. Okay, when his actual dharma is based on what is, for him, entirely self-evident. Giving is good. Self-restraint is good. Contentment is good. Yeah, and to him, these are just self-evident principles. And he doesn't base them, he doesn't say giving is good because the Buddha said it is. Yeah, it's entirely, his ethical framework is entirely secular.
He does qualify there that all should be well learned in the good doctrines of other religions.
Yeah, but he wasn't saying it in a cynical manner, though.
Sorry?
He wasn't saying it as a cynic.
No.
Yeah, he was saying that one should be well learned because the doctrines of other religions have some goodness to them. Okay, medicinal treatments. Everywhere, among peoples in the border regions, blah, 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 everywhere, as far as the Sri Lanka and the Greek king, blah, 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 among the kings and neighbours, everywhere has made provision for two types of medical treatment for humans and for animals. Wherever medicinal herbs are not available, I've had them imported and grown. And along the roads, I've had wells dug and trees planted for the benefits of humans and animals. And again, along the roads, I've had banyan trees planted so that they can give shade to animals and men. You see this a lot in India today, along the sides of the roads, the big fig trees and bodhi trees and stuff everywhere. I've had mango groves planted. At intervals of 8 kroshas, I've had wells dug, rest houses built. In various places, I've had watering places made for the uses of animals and men. But these are but minor achievements. Such things to make the people happy have been done by former kings. I have done these things for this purpose, that the people might practice the dharma. And in the past there was no Dharma Mahamatras, but such officers were appointed by me 13 years after my coronation. Now they work all among all religions for the establishment of Dharma, for the promotion of Dharma, for the welfare and happiness of all who are devoted to Dharma. They work among the Greeks, the Kambojas, the Gandharas, the Rastrikas, the Pitinikas, and other peoples on the western borders. They work among soldiers, chiefs, Brahmins, householders, the poor, the aged, and those devoted to Dhamma for their welfare and happiness, so that they may be free from harassment. And so these are well worth reading the whole of the Ashoka's edicts, but these Dhamma missionaries or ministers, he goes on to say that he sort of sets up these networks where he said, you know, I'm eager to hear any kind of problem or any news from anywhere in my realm, and my Dhamma ministers have been instructed that any time they hear anything, they have to come to me straight away. And they set up this whole kind of network, information network across his empire. And if I hear of any problem, you must inform me straight away so that I can help and make sure that nobody's suffering anywhere. And so these Dhamma ministers are often associated with the missionaries who are mentioned in the Buddhist in the Sri Lankan stories about King Ashoka and the spreading out of Buddhism there. Sorry?
Sri Lankan islands. Protect the animals, not the Buddhists.
Okay. So that's about all we've got time for today. So, we haven't had a look at the Shogun edicts. It's worth having. One of the things that's kind of a little bit interesting about this is that the if you look at the writing, it's a bit crude, you know. Like, I mean, it's carved, but it's not necessarily carved hugely well. But the what's quite stunning in the Ashokan thing is the is the some of the artworks, and what were done at that time. There's a Ashokan pillar here, Vaishali, Sanchi. Later, don't have too much. But you see the extraordinary pillars. Chandra is the moon. Moon. So here's the iron pillar. I think that's got nothing to do with Ashoka. This is the original sandstone. Lion capital. So here's the lion capital. And so those of us who are spending some time over in the cave trying to carve sandstone, you can see in that one, you can see the incredible detail. And what the extraordinary thing about it, which is really, I mean, it's just almost incomprehensible, is that there is not a single piece of sculpture from ancient India before this. Okay, before the Indus Valley, because the Indus Valley, you know, 1,000 years earlier, which was mostly done out of clay, and there's nothing or almost nothing done of sand of in rock before that time, nothing. And then the first thing it appears is this. It's often said that the stone was quarried near Sana, and the stone for all of his pillars was quarried near Sana and trucked around the place. And it's often believed that he had Persian, well, you know those Indian trucks, the Tata ones? Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And it says, please, horn please on the back. Yeah. And it's often believed that they maybe imported Persian sculptors to do the work. Yeah, but you can see that you can even see on the thing is the shine of it, mm-hmm. And they like it. They've got this thing. They actually still shine. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. And they're perfect. I mean, they're perfectly round. I don't have a picture of it, but the pillars, yeah. Even the pillars. Vaishali, yeah, Vaishali is the Sanskrit pronunciation. Yeah. Maybe something else here. Yeah, the Vaishali one. So these were all, the Vaishali one was the only one that was still standing. The rest of them had all fallen down. I've only seen that about 9 o'clock at night, we were watching the LED lights. Beanie. And this was reconstructed. This has the edict about that we read before about the Buddha's birth. Yeah, that's what we mean. Okay. So let's finish by paying respects.